Morning, Council. Ready to proceed?
Morning, Chief Justice, members of this honorable court. Travis Laster of Abrams and Laster on behalf of the appellant, and with the court's permission, I've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, this appeal presents an issue of first impression for this court. And that question is simple and straightforward. Whether a director can assert a derivative action on behalf of the corporation he represents when the board is conflicted and thus cannot act. And we submit that as a matter of law and public policy, the answer to that question must be yes. Now, this question sounds like a pure legal issue, but it has important real-world consequences, and it arises in a real-world fact scenario that shows precisely the types of hurdles that a director faces and precisely why a director needs to be able to bring a derivative suit. Richard Schoen became a director of Troy Corporation in February 2005. He's not some swashbuckling Wall Street master of the universe. He's not some hedge fund barbarian at the gate. He's an accountant. He's a Midwestern accountant from Iowa, and he provides financial advice, and he was asked to be on the board as an outside director by one of its major stockholders. Once he got on the board...
That major stockholder, by the way, is fully capable of bringing a derivative action. Isn't that true?
They could bring a derivative action for standing purposes, Justice Jacobs, but what they cannot do is bring the type of allegations that Mr. Schoen can bring based on his personal knowledge.
Why not? Can't Mr. Schoen communicate with the people who put him on the board?
You would think that under Your Honor's decision in Moore Brothers he could, and that is exactly what we asserted to Troy Brothers, that under Your Honor's decision in, at the Chancery level in Moore Brothers v. Cordon, that he certainly could communicate with Steele, and that Steele should be able to know what he knew. That's not what Troy said. Troy said that if he were to communicate any information that he received on the board from the board up to Steele, that would be a breach of his fiduciary duty, and that they would sue him. And they, in fact, did sue him. That case is pending down below in civil action 1959, and they have asserted that by sharing information with his stockholder, that he could not do that. We tried to litigate that issue in the Court of Chancery in the Section 220 case that Mr. Schoen eventually brought, Your Honor. And it ended up being unresolved, and the confidentiality agreement that ultimately was entered did not resolve that issue in our favor.
So it would be a breach of Mr. Schoen's fiduciary duty to communicate this information to one of the large stockholders of the company, but it wouldn't be a breach of fiduciary duty to communicate it in a lawsuit.
Correct, Your Honor, for two reasons. First of all, because we filed the lawsuit under seal. We asked for permission and got an order from the court permitting us to file this lawsuit under seal so that there would not be the type of disclosure problem that Troy adverted. Also, second reason, Your Honor, under this court's and actually it's more Court of Chancery precedent, even when a stockholder obtains confidential information pursuant to 220, and here we would say pursuant to Mr. Schoen's simple director information right, that information can be used to file a lawsuit, so that's not an improper purpose. But I would say to Your Honor that it does present exactly the same risk to Mr. Schoen, and Troy, in fact, has alleged that his filing of that lawsuit and his use of boardroom information to file the lawsuit constituted a breach of fiduciary duty.
So the risk to Mr. Schoen, which is the same in both cases, led to a choice that wasn't forced on the stockholder. That is, a choice by the stockholder not to bring the suit, but instead to have Mr. Schoen attempt to bring the suit. That's why we're here today.
We're here today because Mr. Schoen chose to bring the suit, because Mr. Schoen has fiduciary duties, because Mr. Schoen is a director, and because Mr. Schoen could allege on personal knowledge that Mr. Gwillim had said that he was in a cash squeeze and wouldn't do anything without Mr. Smith, the CEO's permission.
Sorry, I thought a yes or no would suffice. So was there something
the
inaccurate
answer is,
about
I'm sorry,
that
I thought I said no and then tried to explain, Your Honor. The answer is no, it was not Steele's decision. The answer is that it was Mr. Schoen's decision. And it was Mr. Schoen's decision.
Well, Steele's capable of intervening or bringing its own lawsuit at any time.
That's correct, Your Honor. But Steele cannot make the same type of allegations based on personal knowledge as to what happened on the boardroom and inside the boardroom.
Well, it could take Mr. Schoen's deposition, amend its complaint. It could do any number of things.
But once it got into discovery, Your Honor, but it's well established under this court's case law, Levine, as well as Rule 23.1 motions to dismiss are decided pre-discovery. So the allegations of the complaint that would be considered for 23.1 purposes would be simply what could be alleged by the stockholder. You wouldn't get to depose.
I'm asking the question, these questions for the following reason. You're asking us to decide an issue of first impression that has never been decided in this state, and I'm not sure in very many others, if any. And that's solely because of a contrived choice by the shareholder, who is really the party in interest here, not to bring the suit.
And I'm respectfully disagreeing with Your Honor. We're asking you to decide this issue of first impression because Mr. Schoen, as a fiduciary, was in that boardroom. Mr. Schoen saw with his own eyes what was going on. Mr. Schoen was told that he could not share this information with Steele and that he would be sued if he did, and he indeed was sued. And Mr. Schoen decided to bring the ultimate lawsuit. It was his decision, and we're respectfully asking this court to reach what is an important public policy, we believe. It is not something that will change the face of Delaware law, because I agree with what I think is the underlying premise of one of Your Honor's questions. This hasn't come up, and it's unlikely to come up frequently, because quite often...
Mr. Lester, who did you say brought the 220 suit, Steele or Schoen?
Both did, Your Honor. There were two separate 220 actions. Mr. Schoen initially filed a 220 action to follow up on information requests that he made as a director. It was to get updates on information at the board level.
And it's your position that whatever Steele was seeking to establish some type of wrongdoing and didn't provide Steele with enough information to bring its own suit?
Steele only sued on the basis of valuing its shares, Your Honor, in terms of its 220 action.
So Steele has never tried to bring a 220 action to discover any type of wrongdoing?
My recollection of the demand is that the sole purpose was valuing shares. That's correct, Your Honor, at the Steele level. Now,
Mr. Lester, when you began, you said this was a question of both law and public policy. Are you asking us, given the fact that this is a case of first impression, to enunciate a public policy that results in a change in the current law, or were you suggesting that there is a legal basis already in the statute for your position, and that that legal basis simply reflects a different direction in public policy?
What I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is that there is a legal basis in Delaware law. I freely admit that it is not in 327 because 327 only addresses stockholder derivative suits. But there is a fundamental basis in our law already articulated in this Court's decisions on derivative actions, be that Levine, be that Zapata, that it is a broad, equitable remedy, the purpose of which is to protect the corporation, and it's construed broadly. Historically, it has been a stockholder remedy, but there is ample basis in terms of the equities for this Court to rely on those precedents and trust law to grant director derivative standing. As to public policy, I think this Court's public policies are already well articulated. And those public policies are that we believe in and we empower outside independent directors. I think one of the large reasons why this Court has not seen prior to this a director derivative standing reason is because until the 1980s under this Court's leadership, corporations didn't have outside directors who were thinking about suing. Historically, the board was an insider-dominated institution. This court, through its precedents, changed that. Another reason why this court hasn't seen director derivative standing issues arise is boards are collegial bodies. It takes a significant, first of all, it takes a split decision to give rise to a potential lawsuit. Those are few. Second, it takes a split decision in which one of the directors thinks not that his fellow directors made a mistake, but they actually breached their duties. Then that director has to have the gumption to file a suit, risk the counterclaim. So we're dealing with a small subset, but it's an important issue because we have said, this court has said to directors, you're supposed to monitor management. You're supposed to be active, particularly in the sale of the company context. You're supposed to look out for the stockholders. And yet we're going to say at the end of that, if this chancery decision stands, that at the end of the day, you can't take that final step and ask a court for relief. You essentially have two options. You can continue to ask questions and be ignored, or you can resign. You can't even do a noisy withdrawal under Troy's standpoint because that would be a breach of fiduciary duty. So we would be effectively saying to directors,
it would be a claimed breach of fiduciary duty. It hasn't been established one way or the other that it would be.
Correct, Your Honor. I agree. And again, we have argued vigorously that under Your Honor's decision in More Business Forms, there is no basis whatsoever for them to assert that Mr. Schoen breached his fiduciary duties or could breach his fiduciary duties by sharing with Steele.
Turning quickly to the merits of your position, as I understand it, it is, number one, that there's no statute that precludes a derivative suit brought by a director.
That's
that
correct.
That especially does so. And there is no, except for the opinion that is being appealed from, there's no jurisprudence from this court or the Court of Chancery that expressly proscribes such a suit.
Correct, Your Honor.
So, but that's really stating a negative. By the same token, there's no suit that affirmatively grants a director that power either. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So is it fair to say that as far as the merits of your position is concerned, we're basically dealing with public policy arguments?
We are dealing with public policy arguments and the analogies that we have drawn to trust law, and there is the persuasive authority we submit in terms of the American Law Institute principles, which articulate the same issues we have.
Well, we might as well deal with the elephant in the room, and that is, if a statute authorizes derivative actions be brought by shareholders but does not authorize specifically derivative actions to be brought by directors, why doesn't this court leave it then to the legislature to decide the public policy argument that you make?
Chief Justice, I think we do need to take on that elephant, and the answer is first that that statute does not authorize derivative actions. That statute limits derivative actions. This court and the Court of Chancery and the English courts before it were the source of derivative actions. It is a judicial remedy. It is a judicial remedy created when a corporation has been injured. The corporation is the real party in interest. The corporation cannot act, and therefore somebody must act on its behalf. It's from the courts that this remedy arose.
Do you agree that the statute also does not address debenture holders?
I do, Your Honor. It does not address debenture holders. It doesn't address creditors.
And so debenture holders should be allowed to bring a derivative action?
Debenture holders, if the company is insolvent, I think under this court's decision in GWALA, would be allowed to bring a derivative
action. Not if it's insolvent. Generally.
No, Your Honor, that would not be. What this court would need to do, and I believe debenture holders is already settled by Simmons v. Kogan, but what this court would need to do, I think if there are entities in the corporate family, and so that would be directors, officers, stockholders, debenture holders, note holders, creditors. We've already dealt under this court's precedents with creditors, note holders, debenture holders. We know that until insolvency, they can't sue. In insolvency, they can't. But I think the appropriate question is...
But we know that debenture holders can't sue under HARF.
Correct. Absolutely. So that's a settled issue. But I would think for these other constituencies, the question is, are these appropriate constituencies to represent the corporation in what's effectively next friend status? Are they the type of person that we want to bring derivative claims? And this court has said, and I think appropriately, that in those bondholder slash debenture holder cases, their rights outside of insolvency are primarily contractual. They're not primarily equitable. They're not equitable issues, and so they are not appropriate next friends of the corporation who can sue on behalf of that corporate entity. Stockholders, this court has said, and the Court of Chancery said, are. Now, the legislature limited stockholder rights in 327 because of the concern about strike suits. It didn't create the right. It limited it. Now, what this court is facing, I submit, is the question of whether a director is an appropriate next friend of the corporation when the corporation itself cannot act because the board is conflicted. I do think that there is an argument that an officer in an appropriate circumstance could be a possible derivative plaintiff, but that's not for today. But that I believe is the answer to Your Honor's question. The fact that 327 does not address these different corporate constituencies leaves it to this court to carefully craft the scope of derivative actions and determine who has the right set of traits to be a good derivative plaintiff.
How would this work in terms of the demand requirement?
Troy makes an argument about that, doesn't this put everything up for grabs? if you let directors sue, don't we have to revisit everything? And I suggest no. And that's because this court has a coherent theory of derivative actions. And that coherent theory of derivative actions is that a derivative action exists when the board cannot act, when the board is conflicted. That's because the derivative action in the first instance is a right of the corporation. So ordinarily the board of directors decides what to do with that right. The derivative action
My question was, how does the demand requirement apply to a director?
And that's precisely my next sentence, Your Honor. Because the question is the board conflicted? Can the board act? Necessarily, the director must make a demand or plead demand futility. Because the demand requirement, it's inherent in the nature of a derivative action that we only take these derivative actions away from the board when we can either make demand or plead demand futility. So that is not an issue that I think is out there and up for grabs. I think that's inherent in this court's coherent nature of the derivative action. Likewise, particularity pleading. I think that is inherent in a coherent concept of derivative actions. We don't take these assets of the corporation away from the board unless the board, for some reason, cannot act. And we don't accept mere notice pleading, labels like dominated and controlled, to take actions away from the board. So both demand would apply, demand futility would apply, and particularity would apply.
Okay. That's fine. I have another concern.
Mm-hmm.
If this court were to hold that directors have standing to bring derivative actions, wouldn't that also mean that in addition to standing, they have an obligation to bring derivative actions, that in order to avoid being sued themselves for breaching their fiduciary duties, they would have to be kind of constantly saying to themselves, well, am I distressed enough about what's going on in this boardroom that now I have to bring suit against this corporation?
I think that's an important question, Justice Berger, and I think the answer is, the straight answer, and I want to explain it, is yes, the director would have to consider that. And the director has to consider that right now because a director has what, in Justice Holland's words from Quick Turn, is an unremitting fiduciary duty. You don't get to turn that off when you don't like what the board has done. You have to keep thinking about it, and you have to keep thinking about whether you want to raise it, whether you want to make a noisy withdrawal, whether you want to make another motion, whether you want to sue. Now, that is a concern, but it shouldn't be addressed through standing doctrine because it's already addressed through the business judgment rule. So could you sue a director for not suing to challenge a board action? Sure you could. But that would be, I think, in 99% of the cases, a classic strike suit because that director would have had to not made an informed decision about whether to sue. What director is going to do that? We know they've got the threat of the breach of fiduciary duty counterclaim coming right back at them. Directors have every incentive not to bring strike suits. The director also, alternatively, would have to be shown to have breached their duty of loyalty. Well, in what regard in bringing a derivative action, or more importantly, in your sense, Justice Berger, not bringing a derivative action, could the director have breached his duty of loyalty? So I agree it's a concern. I agree it's a possibility that we could see suits for not suing. But I don't think, Your Honor, that the answer to that is to cut it off at the standing level. I think there's ample protections already in the business judgment rule such that that is simply not a concern.
Mr. Laster, in addressing the public policy arguments for your position, someone, whether this is the entity to do it or not is an issue for me, but someone has to address, given the penchant for and the popularity of independent directors, whether benignly imposed by the federal government or because of good practices for corporate governance, the majority of boards now frequently are independent directors. What does this do for the collegiality of the boardroom if management, institutional directors, and independent directors see each other as adversaries because one may bring suit on behalf of the corporation against their own, quote, colleagues, close quote? Now, whatever the ramifications may be of that, one way or another, are we the institution that should resolve that on one argument in a specific case, or should that be left to the legislature?
Your Honor, I think this court is the entity that should resolve that because this court is the court that has supervised the development of fiduciary duties, that has led the country and the world in terms of the importance of outside directors. And what I think happens to collegiality, Your Honor, is collegiality becomes real collegiality. Because now instead of a torpid and supine board that simply sits back and doesn't listen to the CEO and that the CEO can ignore because he knows the directors at the end of the day can't do anything, it is a collegial board based on real interchange, real debate, and a shared vision. Because what this court has told directors to do in terms of monitoring management and in terms of being involved, they can do. And if they feel there's been a breach, then ultimately they can go to the court to enforce it. I'm in my rebuttal time.
You want to save the balance?
I would like to, if that's all right with the court.
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Michael Weidinger on behalf of the appellees. The Court of Chancery correctly held that Shoon lacks standing. Shoon is a director but not a stockholder, and his argument is premised entirely on policy arguments in an attempt to create a new category of equitable standing for directors, because it's undisputed that there is no basis to exert the existence of legal standing under our law. Because there's no Delaware authority that permits Shoon to bring a case on behalf of a corporation, the vice chancellors.
The argument, Mr. Weidinger, is that there's no Delaware authority that precludes it either, that we essentially have a blank slate here.
I disagree with that, Your Honor, for the following reason. First of all, although the Supreme Court has not addressed it, the decision relied upon by Vice Chancellor Lamb below, the Moran decision, then clearly notes that directors lack derivative standing. The Moran case, the director brought claims seeking to vindicate the rights of shareholders. Those claims were derivative in nature. And the court noted in his effort to plead those claims that he had to meet the requirements of Rule 23.1. Rule 23.1 has multiple requirements, including stockholder.
Well, as I understand it, that aspect of the Moran case was a Court of Chancery decision that was not appealed.
That aspect was not appealed. It was the decision itself was affirmed on appeal.
But so as far as we're concerned, there's no binding Supreme Court authority or precedent.
That's correct, Your Honor. There is no case at the Supreme Court level that holds one way or the other. But clearly, there is no statute that authorizes it. Section 141, which governs boards, basically says that it's the entire board of directors or a properly delegated committee of that board that makes decisions on behalf of the board. And it's that policy that grounds the business judgment rule in respect for those board decisions. Section 327 does not permit a director to bring a claim.
Where in 327 does it say directors can't bring a claim?
Well, what it says is that stockholders can bring a claim. It makes no express mention of a director, and we have argued and submit that that is a conscious decision on the part of the legislature in light of the fact that other statutes, other provisions of the Delaware General Corporation Law, Section 211, Section 220, Section 225, all expressly say a director can bring suit.
You're drawing negative inferences
in
each of those cases, correct?
Correct.
But in 327, it doesn't. It's not so much an authorization for stockholders. It's a limitation on which stockholders can bring derivative suits, right?
It clearly limits what they do, but I think it's also a authorization in the sense that the statute, having now been codified, it grants to the stockholders and demonstrates to those specific stockholders who meet the requirements of that statute and Rule 23.1 that they may bring a suit under our law. Historically, it did not develop that way as it codified. It developed through equitable jurisprudence. But
as a matter of equitable jurisprudence, shouldn't a director be have that authority? I mean, what is it from an equitable standpoint that justifies removing from the director that potentially valuable ability to assist in writing a corporation whose board is not acting properly?
If you look at the cases that grant standing, derivative standing in this jurisdiction, whether it be all the stockholder cases or the recent North American Catholic case with respect to creditors of an insolvent corporation, there's two basic attributes that provide derivative standing. Those attributes are a separation of control and ownership over assets. It's that separation of control that creates a fiduciary obligation to those persons that have standing. Secondly, that person who has standing has that ownership interest. So you have a separation of control that creates a fiduciary obligation, and the person who has standing has that ownership interest. Those are the fundamental equitable principles upon which derivative standing is founded. It's well, not what the board can't act.
What about trust principles? Trustees generally can bring actions. And they don't own anything. Just like a director, they stand as fiduciaries, just like a director, and they are recognized as being appropriate parties to act on behalf of the trust.
They do act as fiduciaries, but they are both in control, and they also have technical legal ownership. There's a distinction. Trustees and directors are not one and the same. Our law has made that clear. CD case has made that clear. There are distinctions between trust, the obligations of trustees, and the obligations of directors. They perform different functions. With respect to ownership, no one can say that a director in any respect has an ownership interest in the company if he lacks any stockholding. On the other hand, a trustee has technical legal ownership. He has title to the trust property. Now, he holds that trust property for the benefit of another, but it's a legal distinction that matters. The equitable principle that's grounded in the creditor, allowing creditors to bring standing, to have standing to bring suit, or that allows stockholders to bring suit, are that they have an ownership stake.
But given
that's just not the case here.
Given that the ownership stake can be as little as one share, that's a pretty thin reed on which to rest your theory, isn't it? I mean, it's almost de minimis.
Well, it can be de minimis, Your Honor. We've made a policy decision that ownership stake matters, and it can be a small ownership stake, but there has to be some stake there. I mean, it has been the case in the past that tender offerors or people who are seeking to take over a company in order to continue to press on all grounds, buy 10 shares of stock or some de minimis amount. But they clearly have a stake in the outcome, even though they only own 10 shares of stock. It's a pretty rare circumstance where somebody who owns one share of stock and nonetheless brings a derivative action because their stake isn't sufficient enough to warrant them taking action.
But they don't have a direct stake. Only if there was a liquidation.
Right. They have an equitable interest. The stockholders have an equitable. They have ownership stake by virtue of stockholding. The creditors have a ownership stake in the circumstance where the company is insolvent.
I'd like you to comment on a quotation from Pomeroy that talks about equitable jurisprudence. A shareholder, stockholder does not bring such a suit because his rights have been directly violated, or because the cause of action is his, or because he is entitled to the relief sought. He's permitted to sue in this matter simply in order to set in motion the judicial machinery of the court. Well, if that's the objective, then why shouldn't a director be allowed to set in motion the judicial machinery of the court?
Well, historically, Pomeroy is saying that a stockholder has the ability to set in motion a suit that will permit the corporation to right a wrong it otherwise wouldn't right. There's that fundamental principle of stock ownership is that the assets of the company are for the benefit of that stockholder, and when the company won't do what it is that stockholder believes is necessary to sue the directors, the stockholder is vested with authority to bring an action on behalf of the company. Historically, it's always been somebody with that ownership stake that's been permitted to bring a claim. A director, there are numerous policy considerations addressed in the briefs that suggest a director simply shouldn't be able on his own to act on behalf of the board.
Well, let's talk about those policy considerations for a moment. Mr. Laster suggests that this court, he uses the word encourages, others might say have aided and abetted the rise of the independent director with whatever that brings to the table, and that this action he asks us to take today as a matter of public policy simply furthers, empowers, and makes even more useful the independent director as he or she sits on the board, that they would have some real clout and not just illusory clout as independent directors if they're given the right to bring a derivative action on behalf of the corporation. Two questions. One, is that an issue to which we should respond rather than the legislature? And two, do you agree that that's sort of the necessary corollary to a true independence as a director?
It's absolutely the case, I think, that the general legislature, General Assembly, should address that in the first instance. It is a complex public policy issue that historically this court has never granted standing to a director and ought to be addressed by the General Assembly in the first instance. Second, I think it just disrespects independent directors. It basically says that they are still remain unempowered to do what's right for the corporation. I don't think that's correct. I think that independent
that's what we're being told in the case of Mr. Schoen, that if he tries to do the right thing, he stands in jeopardy of breaching his fiduciary duty, and indeed has been sued by your company for having done that.
Well, I think that the risks exist at any time, whether they bring a their own independent action or they disclose confidential information of the company to stockholders, that there's a risk that they'll be sued for some breach of their own fiduciary duties. Mr. Schoen raises the specter of his inability to act. It's just not correct. He's brought a books and records action. Steele has brought a books and records action. It's the concern that Steele and Mr. Schoen would use that confidential information and provide it to a third party that has caused the underlying litigation in this case.
Can I interrupt there because I'm a little confused conceptually? In this case, we have a director who owns no stock. What if Mr. Schoen owned one share of stock? Under your view, Mr. Schoen would not be allowed to bring a derivative action in his capacity as a director, but he would be allowed to bring a derivative action in his capacity as a stockholder. But taking it one step farther, if I understand you, he would not be able to allege in his derivative suit anything he knows by virtue of being a director. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. He wouldn't be able to allege confidential information that, if disclosed to the public, would be a breach of his fiduciary duty if it would injure the company. But it's not to say that he's not allowed to use information that he has to bring a lawsuit as a stockholder. Or he can simply use that information. And as he's done in this case, he's gotten information, Steele has gotten information, and Schoen has chosen to file a lawsuit with that information. He's got other options available to him rather than granting him standing.
He's been sued because he brought that lawsuit, correct?
He's been counterclaimed for, not because of that lawsuit, he's been counterclaimed for allegations that he breached his fiduciary duty by providing confidential information to third parties.
So in your view, what's the gap between what Shun knows and what he's not allowed to tell Steele that's preventing Steele from bringing the suit? As you heard Mr. Laster, he seemed to suggest Steele doesn't have enough information to bring the suit. You're now telling us it's all right to communicate with Steele when you're the director elected by Steele, but you can't breach any confidences. It seems that if you really have a legitimate derivative claim, it wouldn't necessarily implicate anything that's confidential.
That's correct. It wouldn't necessarily. You could have a derivative claim. He's without specifically disclosing confidential information of the company. Mr. Shun doesn't lack power to act, as he suggests that he must sue the company. There are any number of things he can do, including, as was suggested, make a noisy withdrawal.
What I'm focusing on is what's the problem that's got this miscommunication or lack of communication between Shun and Steele?
I don't know that there is one. That's what's alleged by Mr. Laster. There's a confidentiality agreement that's in place, as I understand it, in the underlying 220 books and records action, and the information is available in to the parties to that consolidated action. I don't think there's an information gap, as is suggested.
As a matter of public policy, kind of an extension, if you're a director and you're in the boardroom and there's clearly wrongdoing, do you submit that the other directors can cloak their wrongdoing with some type of confidentiality?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that you can. I think that the directors have a duty to disclose to stockholders information. If there's a concern about confidentiality on the part of the director who believes that there's been a breach and believes that he must turn over that information, but also believes that doing so might breach his fiduciary duty because it's confidential information, there are other avenues for him to act rather than just simply filing a lawsuit on a derivative basis. He could seek an order from the Court of Chancery describing the problem and seeking the ability to disclose that to the stockholders if he feels that he's hamstrung. The Walt Disney case suggests that that can be done by stockholders. It's always the case that we have stockholders who bring Section 220 cases that then receive confidential information, and then they use that confidential information to bring lawsuits.
So you're saying that a director could act like a trustee and file a suit in the Court of Chancery asking for instructions?
I'm suggesting that a director who has information that he believes he needs to disclose to stockholders could, and who felt that didn't want to take the risk, the personal risk, that he was going to disclose it, didn't want to take the risk that he would be sued for disclosing confidential information, could
right,
simply,
what would he do?
Well, he could do a number of things. He could make a withdrawal. First of all, it would be necessary to disclose that confidential information for him to do so. He could make a withdrawal that doesn't that points to stockholders to that there may be a wrongdoing.
What if he wants to continue as a director?
If he wants to continue as a director and he believes that he's got confidential information, he believes that the stockholders are entitled to that information, he cannot convince the board that they're required to disclose that information, I think he could seek a order from the Court of Chancery which simply says this information is or is not confidential and is or is not
which, as I say, if such a proceeding exists or is permissible, it would be analogous to a trustee who has authority to go into the Court of Chancery and ask the court for instructions on how to interpret the trust or how to interpret some obligation that he or she may have as trustee, right?
Well, I don't know that it's directly analogous, but it is certainly the case that a director who has information, of corporate information, could, I believe, take steps to try to protect his interests so that he's not subject to a lawsuit.
But aren't you basically saying that a director can go to court to deal with a wrong or, you know, a need to disclose some information to the stockholders, but for some reason can't go to the court to ask for relief on behalf of the corporation that he serves based upon the same problem, whatever it may be?
No, I don't think so. I think he's got personal information on personal knowledge as a result that he was there, and he believes that he's required to disclose that information. This, I think, is a classic example of somebody who's able to go and seek relief from a court, an equitable court, to simply get instructions that he's allowed to disclose information that he has in his personal knowledge but, in fact, is not his. It's not a derivative claim on behalf of the company. He's making a direct claim.
Right, I understand. And you're saying he can do that, but he can't make a derivative claim about the same underlying issue that he feels needs to be disclosed to the stockholders.
I believe that he should not be able to act on behalf of the company with respect to bringing a lawsuit that is a board decision. Finally, I'd like to note that in the briefs, counsel has raised the threat of countersuit if plaintiff raises issues and discloses information, and I submit that the countersuit that the plaintiff is concerned about is much more tangible in a circumstance where a director acts on an individual basis to bring solely without the benefit of the rest of the board's decision to bring an action on behalf of the company. It basically brings to the forefront an invitation for the company to bring a counterclaim. Now, in this particular case, it is Troy's position that Mr. Shoon is acting at the behest of a minority stockholder to seek a liquidity plan. That's not acting on behalf of the company or the best interests of all of Troy's stockholders. And it's undoubtedly the case that should this case proceed, because Shoon is granted standing, that there'll be counterclaims against Shoon on that basis. So he faces these risks in a much more tangible way if he's granted the right to bring the suit that he seeks.
We'd be letting a Trojan horse into the boardroom.
We have, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your Honors, regarding whether the issue is Mr. Schoen communicating to third-party stockholders or to Steele, it's clear from CA number 1959 and the complaint in this action, of which this court can take judicial notice, it's a filing in the courts of Delaware, that Troy is asserting both. Troy is asserting that Mr. Schoen cannot speak to his stockholder representative. Why is that important? Because it emphasizes the risk that a director faces if they choose to go and sue derivatively, and which gives their suit credibility. These issues will arise. This will not be a bright-line situation where it is clear and a sign is hanging on it that says, this is wrongdoing that you can disclose. Nor is it likely to be a small potatoes matter. Imagine a director who learns of a CEO side deal and a major multi-billion-dollar deal that's moving fast towards signing. That director should be able to do something. Obviously, he's going to go to the board first.
Right,
obviously,
you've used the word if that director chose to bring a derivative action. If we accept your position, won't the director have to bring a derivative action?
No, Your Honor, for the same reasons that I discussed with Justice Berger, that director will not be obligated to. That director can make a business judgment as to whether it's warranted under the circumstances to bring that derivative action. But the important thing is that director, if he does bring a derivative action, faces a huge threat of damages in that counterclaim. And so this court can be confident that this is not a strike suit situation. This is not a situation where directors are going to do that willy-nilly. This is not letting a to use your phrase, Justice Jacobs, a Trojan horse in the boardroom where the Greeks are going to pour out and overwhelm the Trojans. Directors are only going to do this when it matters, when it's serious, and when there is, you know, something clear in their mind that they need to do this. There are five reasons why directors should be allowed to sue as a matter of public policy. Five reasons why they are the best actor to be allowed to bring derivative claims. This is a claim on behalf of the corporation, and it's one of which the director has intimate personal knowledge. Typically, he is there. He will have been there. He will know. This court has repeatedly criticized conclusory complaints by plaintiffs who either haven't used 220 or haven't pled specific allegations. A director has personal knowledge. He can allege the type of detailed information that is in our complaint and to which I would encourage you to look.
Can I interrupt for a moment?
Yes, Your Honor.
Harking back to a question that the Chief Justice asked, suppose that Section 327 did not exist, or any other statute that made reference to derivative suits, would a shareholder then be entitled to bring a derivative suit?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Shareholder derivative actions, that's, you know, a 16th through 18th century development that happened parallel in the courts of England and then subsequently here in the States. So, yes, 327 is not an empowering statute at all. It's a limiting statute. Stockholders would inherently have that right. So, second reason, directors have a fiduciary obligation to sue, or potentially sue, at least consider suing. Third, they have an electoral mandate to protect the corporation. Fourth, they have information rights. 220 for stockholders is simply not a replacement for the type of information a director has. There is no book or record in this world that will report that Mr. Gwillim said that he doesn't dare do anything without Mr. Smith's approval, or that Conrad Plimpton wrote that after he got bought out by Troy, it was a rainbow after the flood. Those are the types of detailed issues about board entrenchment that only a director will know. These suits have credibility. I would encourage this court not to cede its longstanding role to the legislature. This court, there are many issues of Delaware law that this court has carefully developed. The business judgment rule, judge-made doctrine. Unical, judge-made doctrine. Revlon, judge-made doctrine. We could be a Model Business Code Act state. We could let the legislature do all this. But this court has expertise. This court has a leadership role. It's the appropriate entity to make this type of decision. In the end, directors are ideal derivative plaintiffs. This is not a 100-suit, strike-suit lawsuit that's driven by a lawyer. We all know that that's what many derivative suits are. A director is going to bring a real suit with real claims, and he's the type of person who should be allowed to sue. I appreciate this court's time. If your honors have any questions, otherwise, I'm finished.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.